patient on page 552 and what else I just described. Talk a little bit about this. A girl that comes to my home group that says, life is tough. First you get the test, then you get the lesson. Then, if you don't get the lesson, you get the test again. And I think that might be right. And so, at least in part, this fourth step is about laying that down. And I heard in a meeting in Atlanta when I was sober about 5 years, a guy defined freedom, and I think he got it. He said, freedom is when I accept full responsibility for all of my own actions. Up until that point, I may have been at large, but I'm not free, because freedom includes responsibility. So steps 4 through 9 have to do with responsibility. They have to do with acting like an adult. A friend of mine says whenever she's confused and doesn't really know what her next move should be, she stops and asks herself this question, what would an adult do in a situation like this? And I find that helpful for whatever it's worth. My experience with removing my own defects of character, see, I have no power over them. I was at a trade show in Chicago, sober a couple of years, and I was selling hardware and plumbing and electrical kinds of stuff. And I was at a big trade show in McCormick, and I was removing my own defects of character. I don't know if anybody else in here has had that experience, but you can get a brain hernia doing that. And I was walking, and I was working on what I think of as character defect number one. I call it CD1. You know which one it is, right? Yeah, lust is, yeah, that's it. And so I'm walking down the aisle, and I'm not even going to see these ladies, right? Not even going to see them. I'm removing this character defect. And I come by this particular space, and these people make shower heads, and they have invented this new shower head that does this pulsing thing. And they have got a glass shower stall at about waist level, and there's a gorgeous young woman in there wearing about 6 or 8 cents worth of bathing suit. It couldn't have been more than that, taking a shower, demonstrating this thing. And I'm going to walk by there and not even notice it, right? I almost hurt myself trying to stop those thoughts. And I left there and I went to a meeting, and I walked out of that meeting still crazy. And I said to a woman standing on the street right after the meeting, I said, where's the next meeting? She said, there's a men's meeting around the corner and you better go. So I guess it was visible. So I walked in and I sat down in this men's meeting, and this guy told my story. I was astounded where he had done that. And my sponsor tells me that I have no power over my defects of character. None. And that my defects of character are all self-centered, without exception. Without exception, they're self-centered. And self does not have the power to push self out of the center, and if it did, it would leave a vacuum. And the answer to my defects of character is for me to try to become God-centered. And on the days when I do that, my defects of character just recede. And I guess that the darkness can't exist in the light. And the fourth step for me is the beginning of the shining of the light onto the truth. I said before that I don't have the power to forgive, and I don't believe that I do. But I have the power to receive God's gift of forgiveness. See, when I got here, I was like this. And as I have done this step work and hung out with you people, I have begun to open to receive what's always been here for me as a free and clear gift. And one of those gifts is forgiveness. I have used this program on all of my resentments. I have one, and it's funny, I never think about it. It never crosses my mind. If he walked into the room, I wouldn't think about it. I was in a business deal a number of years ago, and I'm a commission salesman. And the commission on my side was going to be $50,000 a year. That's a lot of money to me. And that's been 16 years ago, so I'm about $800,000 in the hole on this one right now. And you know, the only time, nothing happens in here when I say that. Nothing goes off inside. I don't have any feelings about that anymore. I hope that guy does great. I wish him the best. I think he's doing the best he can do. And I'm doing the best I can do. Because I can't afford the price of hating one of the master's kids. We pray in the prayer that they close most of the meetings with, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I'm asking to be graded by my own standards. I have consequently relaxed my standards. Pretty clear that I can't afford the price. The price is just too high. And these are the directions for me so that I can receive the forgiveness. And I have someone pray these prayers through their list one at a time. And I don't care. The shortest list of resentments I ever saw that I thought was complete was about 40. And the longest I ever saw was 450, and it was incomplete. I'm pretty sure of that. And I don't care how long. One at a time. Let's go back and pray for these people. To me, resentment is kind of like black ice around my heart. And as I hold in prayer that black heart up to the sunlight of the Spirit, that sunlight melts that ice. And depending maybe on how long I've had the resentment and how much I've nursed it and how big it is, or maybe how close I can hold it to the sunlight, eventually it will melt. And I can find myself praying for God to give me tolerance, pity, and patience for this person and find that I have it. And that I can hope he has a great life and a spiritual experience, and his kids go to school on scholarship, and his wife gets promoted at work, and you know, and I just wish him the very best. And that goes for the man I just described to you right now. And I don't have the power to do that. I absolutely do not have that power, but this program does. The forgiveness process is in the fourth step. Cleverly hidden, I might add, but it's right there. And that ends the first third of the inventory. That generally shoots about 80% of the time necessary. I'm ahead of myself. There's one more. It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Now, that's difficult to do if I'm still mad at them. I think that's why the prayer work and the observations are so important. I got to dig that poison out. And it doesn't say that I look for my part. If I'm looking for my part, I still think they got a part. So I need to get to the forgiveness piece in place before I get to here. It says, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. I have made mistakes. That's what we're going to look for. Where had we been? All right, here's your fourth column. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. I would note that those are all functions of self. They are all parts of self. Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. So I'm going to do a fourth column and take a look at whether I had been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened. And then it calls for another list down here. It says, when we saw our faults, we listed them. I think that's a separate list. Sit down and write down, what were my faults? They're all self-centered. We placed them before us in black and white. We covered that. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. Interesting how the fourth and eighth steps are so closely related. Much more closely than four and five. Because here I'm willing to sweep up my side of the street. And that's what the eighth step is going to be about. And that's it on resentment. And now we go to the fear portion of the inventory. It says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with these folks. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. And then here's an indictment. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But now, we ourselves set the ball rolling. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Apparently that's going to have to go too. And they're going to tell us how to do that. Astonishingly enough, the directions are right here. It says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. To me, that's not a direction. That's a general description. They're going to tell us very specifically how to do that. It says, we put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. I suggest that if you've got the spiral notebook thing, turn three or four pages so you have room for some more resentments if you happen to think of some. Dog ear one. And start listing your fears. Start writing them down. And it's everything. And it's fears of fear of failure, fear of success. You may not know you have that. Take a hard look. I was afraid of success. I was afraid I was going to succeed, and I knew it was dumb luck, and they were going to expect me to do it again. I was scared to death of that. I did much better with failure. Fear of snakes? Afraid of death? Afraid of flying? Well, not flying. Afraid of crashing and burning in an airplane? Take an inventory. Take a look. Talk to your sponsor about it. I recommend sponsorship a lot. I'm going to talk about that here in a little while. It says we put them on paper. It doesn't tell us specifically how, and that's the only written instruction that I can find in the fear inventory. So I just say write one down and just keep writing. Just start making a list of your fears. Shouldn't take long. And it says we put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So some of my fears have resentments connected to them and some of them don't. So that's saying all fears, you got one, put it down. And then it says, we asked ourselves why we had them. I am so grateful that they answered that question in the next sentence because I had no idea. I couldn't have answered the question. It said, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? So let's observe one at a time. that I have these fears because I rely upon myself. And it emphasizes that in these next few sentences, all saying the same thing. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. I want to read from page Roman numeral 16 in the text. This is from the foreword to the second edition. It's referring to Bill. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the belief and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. What I want to point is that last phrase, the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. Those are two separate concepts. I can believe there's a God and not have a higher power. To believe in God and to depend on God are different concepts. I think that's pretty powerful. It was for me. So it says here, I'm back on page 68, for we are now on a different basis rather than relying upon myself. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Second half of the first step, my life's unmanageable. I don't get to pick the role. He does. But I'm given a gift, and I believe this with all of my heart. I was afraid I was going to have to be a missionary in Africa or something like that, that I didn't want to do. And somebody pointed out to me one time that God has this particular animal that He gave a taste for the very tenderest leaves that grow on the top of a particular tree. And He also gave the giraffe the long neck so that He could get to them. The idea is that God's will is a good deal. There's a secret, huh? God's will for me is a good deal. Hold that one for a while. But it's a package deal. It's two bowling balls. My will, God's will, pick one. It's not 95 and 5. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? The permission to make a mistake is in that sentence. Did you hear it? It says, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us. I don't have to do what God would have me do. I don't always know what it is. I have to take my best shot. And when I'm trying to do what I think the Master would have me do, like I said before, I'm still making mistakes, but I'm making much finer quality mistakes. And I'm learning by living with the results of them because I insist on embracing my results now. That's permission to make a mistake. We never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness, paradoxically it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. There's a rather direct piece of information. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. And here's a prayer. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. I would like to note it does not say what He would have us do, but what He would have us be. And once we commence to outgrow fear, there's a promise. Kind of interesting. We outgrow fear. Fear must be lack of growth. If I can outgrow it, what kind of growth? Spiritual growth. Growth toward God. Growth toward being the kind of guy He'd have me be. Growth toward dependence on God rather than dependence upon me. Powerful stuff. That's it for the fear inventory. There was a list. There were some observations. There was a prayer. It says now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we don't have enough of it or it isn't the right kind. I'm going to skip down. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I don't either. If they didn't want to be, I don't want to be. And the only time I feel good pointing at it with a man that I sponsor is if I think he's betting his sobriety on it. I've had the occasion this year of doing that in extremely direct terms, and I think he narrowly missed a real bad one. says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human without, if we didn't. What can we do about them? Here are the directions. It says we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. That's interesting. Our own conduct. I'm not reviewing anybody else's. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? What I like to do on that one, and I do this, I hope, with a great deal of humility, is I like to take the second one first, because this will lay out pretty easily in a column inventory if you'll start out with whom had we hurt as a column. And the second one being, where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? The third column being, did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? And then the fourth column said, where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? My fourth column is very simple. Generally, it says, I should have left her alone. Or it says, I should have told her the truth. It's short. Because this is not a course in self-flagellation. We're not here to beat me up over the things that I've done wrong. It tells me in the next paragraph, well, let me go before that. It says, we got this all down on paper and looked at it. So we're going to put this all on paper so we can look at it and observe. We're making the list so we can make the observations. What are we trying to accomplish? This is what it says here. It says, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. So that's what we're trying to do with this. Not beat me up, but figure out what I'm supposed to do from here. I like to ask the men that I sponsor to write a paragraph, which is less than a third of a page, on what they believe their sex ideal should be. It's done prayerfully. It says down here, we subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? It's back to self. The thread runs all through it. Here's a prayer. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up with them, up to them. So I ask him to pray that prayer, sit down and write a paragraph as to what you believe your sex ideal is. What would God have you do in the sex arena? And I tell him that you don't have to chase the what ifs. Right? If you are currently married, then write it down. You don't have to figure out what it would be if you still loved her, but she was seeing somebody else and you were almost legally separated, but not quite, but the lawyers were talking. Right? We don't need to know that. We're back to a day at a time, very simply. What is it today? When your situation changes, we'll talk again. I invite them to share that with me if they want to. Some do, some don't. It's none of my business. I'm willing to listen to it. I'm not even asking to. I'm just available as a sponsor to it. It says, we remember always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends. Here we go again with the amends, just like the eighth step. It isn't that hard. Trust me. It's not that hard. Some of them don't even remember yet. They don't. Isn't that terrible? That's the worst part of it, I think. Make amends where we've done harm. We treat sex as we would any other problem. And here we go again into the prayerful things. This time it's meditation. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. So I sit quietly in the Master's presence with a question. And I listen for the answer. And it comes. And I bounce it off my sponsor to make sure. Suppose we fall short. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but it's only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. I can sign that too. That's true. I've seen that. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray. Here we are praying again. My sponsor says, and it came as a big surprise to me, that God knows all about sex. As a matter of fact, he thinks God may have invented it. That's right. He says, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation. That's interesting. I only need the guidance in the questionable situations. Generally, I know what to do. More specifically, I know what not to do. For sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. And I just love this. It says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. I watched this guy that I'm talking about almost and got him heavily active in helping others. And I don't want to be real specific about that. Got him doing a lot of 12-step work. And the problem went away for him. The problem went away. Because it's just a selfishness. It is very simply a selfishness. It's all it is. It says we think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartbreak. I have seen that happen. Having trouble with this one? 3 nights a week, take a meeting into a prison. See what happens to you. Get down to central office and start answering the phones. Get early to your home group. Make the coffee. Set up the chairs. Stay late. Wash the cups. Put the ashtrays away. Fold the chairs. Get out there and get it on the road for the newcomer and see what happens. It will go away. I have been astounded to watch what's happened on that. Absolutely astounded. And now we have what pilots call a checklist. It says, if we have been thorough about our personal inventory, well, there's an if. We have written down a lot. Well, if you follow these directions that we have just discovered in this book, you will have written down a lot. It says, we have listed and analyzed our resentments. Okay, I remember where we did that. We covered those directions. It says, we have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We've talked about how futile they were. We've talked about dying from them. I bet there are other people in this room who've seen that. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Yeah, we looked at that. It says, we have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. I remember that. We did some prayers and observations about that. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct. We did that in the sexual misconduct inventory. We did that in the resentment inventory. And are willing to straighten out the past if we can. Yep. I remember where we saw that. So it seems to me that if we've done those things, then we've been complete. I've got some other notes that I want to read from my own experience. And I'm going to go back to fear for just a second. There was a fellow named Johnny who used to come to my home group. And he had a tire iron under his front seat. And he had a knife in his pocket, and he had a pistol in his boot, and he had some shotguns at the house. And he says, I ain't afraid of nothing. And when he'd been sober about 6 months, he said, you know what? I'm afraid of everything. That's why I got to have all that. It's funny how little I know about myself until I begin to take these inventories. A lot of what I believed about me turned out to be untrue. If you had asked me the day before I got sober if caffeine affected me, I would have said absolutely not. And it didn't. And if you drink as much scotch as I was, it probably wouldn't affect you either. And it took me a year to figure out that I can't do caffeine. I can have a cup in the morning. I can have an iced tea at lunch. I have to stop there. Because if I have a cup of coffee, even decaf with you good people at an 8 o'clock meeting, I'm not sleeping that night. How many other things are there about me that I didn't know when I got here? It was important to me. Because this magnet through the junkyard of life metaphor that we talked about before, as these things drop away, we're going to discover who I really am. And I didn't have a clue. I didn't have the faintest notion who I was, because I had been an act all of my life. I had pretended to be who I thought you wanted me to be all my life, and I didn't know who I was. I did not know. I have a friend, a woman who was held at gunpoint in a bank robbery. She's in recovery. And when she came out of that situation, she analyzed it and she said, you know, my fear was all in the future. Granted, I'm standing there in the bank and this guy's got a stocking over his head and a pistol in my ear holding me like this. But she said, you know, I was really okay. I wasn't doing what I wanted to do and I wasn't physically very comfortable. But my fear was in the future. Fear is in the future. There's a fellow named Doug D. out of Dallas who does a wonderful discussion about self. And I've changed it slightly, but it's that resentment and depression are when I wasn't getting my will in the past. Anger is when I'm not getting my will right now. And fear is the concern that I will not get my will in the future. What is the problem? Continues to come back to my will. Isn't it astounding? Isn't it just astonishing? I'll tell you, back on the fear thing just a little bit too. I had a guy after I did one of these sessions one time say, well, he said, the reason I look both ways before I step off a curb is because I'm afraid I'll get run over by a bus. To me, that's not a fear. That sounds to me like intuitively no, that it's in my own best interest to look both ways before I step off of a curb. When we talk about fear, I'm talking about that gut-wrenching, petrified thing. And I've had the experience of needing to get rid of some fears on a couple of occasions. I had some things that turned brown and began to stink rather badly in my business a while back, and I found myself in fear again. And what fear is a reassertion of my will. It's the reemergence of ego every time. And what I had to do was a prayer that I discovered was a way to... I've heard people since I got sober, they say, turn it over to God. Nobody can tell me how. I found out how. What I do is I take a situation and I discover by inventorying what do I think is the very worst possible thing that can happen here. Now, that's a judgment on my part. I'll give you that. But what do I think is the worst case? In this particular situation, the worst case was I lose the business, I go bankrupt, I lose the house, I lose one of the cars, and I have to get a real job working for somebody else. All right? Because I'm self-employed. That's the worst thing I could imagine that could possibly happen. And so I took that as a package to God. And I said, if this is your will, send it. And I didn't mean it. See, that was a problem. That was the problem right there. It's because I wanted it my way. Because I figured if I could turn over what I thought was the worst case, I'd turn over everything else. And I prayed that prayer every time I thought about it. See, my spirituality had been gone for a couple of weeks, and it took me that long to realize that it was gone. My spiritual contact was gone. And I prayed that morning and night, added it to my morning and evening prayers, and every time I thought about it during the day, I laid that thing out, and I said, Father, if this is your will, send it on. And I didn't mean it, and I didn't mean it, and I didn't mean it, and I kept praying it. And all of a sudden, one day, I meant it. And what happened is I'd step back into the sunlight of the Spirit. See, the first requirement for me to have anything, if I'm going to walk this walk, is I don't have to have it. If I've got to have it, I've put it before God, and I stand in its shadow. The first requirement is I must be able to hold it in an open hand. I must be. And I held at that time, finally, I got my job, my economic situation held in an open hand again. And I'm not saying this is cause and effect, but 3 days later it turned around and took off like a rocket. I don't know. But the important piece is that I was at peace. It was okay. Because as long as I had this program, this contact with God, as long as I could stay sober and be one of you people, I was going to be okay. My will, God's will. Two bowling balls. Pick one. It's not 95 and 5. I'll handle money and sex and he can handle the rest. It's not the deal. It's not the package. It's not what the third step prayer said. It's not what it said. It worked for me. What I discovered was that I'm trapped. When I got sober, I discovered... See this right here? See it right there? You probably think of that as skin. That's a prison. I'm stuck in here. You know what I mean? I used to get out all the time. You know, I'd go be somebody else. I did a lot of things I used to be able to do. I'm stuck now. And the first thing I had to do if I was going to live in here, 24/365, was clean it up so I could stand it. And the fourth step is the beginning of the house cleaning. I heard a girl in a meeting at the Mustard Seed in Chicago. If you ever get a chance to get up there, it's a great clubhouse. She said, my priority is not what I say it is. My priority is what I do. Priority is what I do. If I want to know what my priorities are, I don't listen to my words about the future. I take the evening half of the 11th step and look into my past and see what got done. And what got done was a priority. And what did not get done was not a priority. And anything that I am saying to the contrary is a lie that I'm telling me. And I did not like that the first time I heard it. And it's the truth. And I think that's why it's so important for me. So what's my priority? My priority is what gets done. It's what is accomplished. Important piece. There's something else to me that's very important. We talk in the third step about God's will, and that was a frightening concept. So many of us as children were told when Aunt Sarah died that it was God's will. I mean, God's will got a bad name. And I had to take my own concept, what I believe that phrase, God's will, meant, break it into two pieces. And one of them is things like, what am I going to be when I grow up? Where am I going to live? Who am I going to live with? How much money am I going to make? What's going to happen to my children? Do the communists eventually take over the world? Every bit of that violates one day at a time. And not being in management, according to the first step, I don't need to know. Leaves me with my own concept of God's will. And that is very simply, what would the Master have me do today? And I know what God's will is for me. Is to act like one of his kids. I'm a citizen. I vote. I drive a car. Put your blinker on around me in traffic. I'll let you in. I say please and thank you. Yeah. That's big news in Nashville. Some days. I'm trying to be a good dad to my kids. I'm trying to be a good husband to this fabulous wife that I have. And I act like I'm married all the time. All the time. I'm an alcoholic. I've got a sponsor. I sponsor some guys. I go to a lot of meetings. I read the text. I read 2 pages a day in the big book, just 2. It's a discipline. I read the big book 4 times a year, 2 pages a day. That's all. The word discipline and the word punishment meant the same thing in the home I grew up in. The word discipline comes from the same root word as the word disciple. It means follower. So when I discipline myself, I don't punish me. What I do is I choose to follow. So I know what God's will is for me. It's to act like one of his kids. I'm a child of God. I pray. I meditate. And I try to treat you guys like brothers and sisters. Loved brothers and sisters. I know what God's will is. There's an important piece for me in the third step. Really important. A lady I know in Nashville says that prayer is not a chance to change God's mind. It's not a sales opportunity. It's an opportunity for God to change my mind, which is the one that needs to be changed. I want to talk just a little bit about sponsorship. My fifth sponsor died in May 4 years ago. And Don was a beautiful guy, and he had... I could talk about him for the next hour. I'm going to stifle myself and just say that I needed to be sponsored. Sober 11 years, and I needed to be sponsored, and there was no question about it. And if you're new and you're looking for a sponsor, I want to tell you what I looked for. Because I had had the 5 best sponsors any man ever had. And I asked myself, what were their common characteristics so that I could look around and find one? And this is what they were. They'd all been men. I don't sponsor women, and I'm not sponsored by women. They had to be men who had done the 12 steps. Because the 12 steps are the program. So I need somebody that's in the program who could help me stay in the program. Well, if they haven't... At my home group, they say, if you can't anymore give away something you ain't got, then you can come back from somewhere you ain't been. And so it had to be somebody that had been there. It had to be somebody who had a sponsor himself. And there are a couple of good reasons for that. One is that it means he surrendered to somebody. The second one, more important to me, is that the first time I come to him with a question he can't answer, we got a plan. We know where we're going. We're going to his sponsor. I'll tell you how good our plan is. I happen to know for a fact that his sponsor's got a sponsor. We got a great plan. It was important for me to have a sponsor who would tell me the truth. It means it has to be somebody who doesn't need me for a best friend. I need someone who will tell me what I do not want to hear. That's important to me. It has to be someone for me who's active in service work, because I think all the winners are. They're taking meetings into prisons and jails and treatment centers, and they're showing up at the detoxes, and they're secretary of their group, and they're setting up, and they're tearing down, they're answering the phone. You know what the service work is. I got to have somebody who's doing that, because I need a winner. That's what I need. And I think maybe the last and probably the most important characteristic is I need a sponsor that laughs a lot. I would not have a sponsor who wasn't having a great time. Because my experience has been that the people who do this step work, who get to the 12th step, who have the spiritual awakening and try to practice these principles in all their affairs, are having a ball. Now, there are moments when that isn't true. But overall, they're having a fantastic time. If you ever get to Nashville, look up Ice Cream Steve. He's my sponsor, and he is a nutcase of the first order, and I know he's going to hear this tape, and he will not be upset when he hears it. He'll think that was funny. You got to see this guy walk into a prison, walk into a cell with 78 convicts, and get in their face. He is not afraid, and he's having a ball. He's nuts. And I want to feel like he looks. I wouldn't have a sponsor that wasn't having a great time. Page 132 in the text, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. My sponsors need to do that. And so I looked around when Don Roy died, and there stood Ice Cream Steve. And here we are 4 years later, and he and I are still sober and just having a fabulous time. If you're new here, do somebody a favor and let them sponsor you. Do somebody a favor and let them sponsor you. I need the men that I sponsor. And the men that they sponsor, they need them. It's a wonderful thing to have the opportunity to see the light come on in somebody's eyes as they do this work. And I thought that I was, when I asked the first guy to sponsor me, I thought I was saying, I'm a dead weight, would you drag me? And that wasn't it. What I was saying was, I think you're on the path. May I walk beside you? We will help each other. And that's been my experience in sponsorship. I believe the easiest men in this fellowship to sponsor are the men who are sponsoring newcomers themselves. Their stuff, see, I'll sit here nodding. Their issues vanish. They absolutely vanish. All of a sudden, a guy who was nuts and it wasn't going well at work and it wasn't going well at home and he had all these problems, he picks up a newcomer, and I only get 2 phone calls from him the next week. One of them is to ask me a question about sponsorship, and the other one is to tell me something absolutely hilarious that rookie has either said or done, right? And that pattern holds from then on. and all of a sudden his issues have vanished. Do somebody a favor. Let him sponsor you. I think it's really important. I'd like to say again that I do not consider myself to be an expert on this thing, but I am willing to try to field questions about the fourth step or anything else if anybody wants to try it. And otherwise, we're going to call this a ball game. We got a microphone. If you would get on the microphone, are we still taping, Mark?
Yeah, we're taping.
Yeah, if you'd... Oh, okay. And I will get you to the barbecue on time, I promise it.
Go ahead.
I got a question. You said you'll write the name down, and then you write 19 words after that. How many times can you write that name, same name down?
Okay, first place is that's not what I said. I said you write the name, you skip one line. You write the name, you skip one line. You're already going across the page. All right. Make sure you got your full list of names first.
Uh-huh.
Write them once. 19 words, that's it. Because, see, first place, if you work across the page, all it does is feed the resentment. You get those feelings inside like you got right now because you're thinking about whatever this is. And the second thing is, if you continue to write about it, it just feeds that. And we're not trying to feed it. We're trying to get it on paper so we can make the observations, do the prayers, and extract it. That's what it's about. 19 words. That's plenty. You can say it. Screwed me in a business deal. Doesn't treat me fairly. Beats on me. Abused me as a child. 19 words. That's my suggestion. Whatever your sponsor says, by the way, I agree with. Each has their own experience. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm from Tampa, Florida, the Safe Haven Group. This is the first time I've ever sponsored anybody, and it happened last week, and I've got three of them right now. And I left, like, one open-ended question to these three people, and they jumped all over it. I said, hey, if you want to run through the big book, if you just want to go over a few things, just let me know. And two of them let me know on one day, and one let me know on the other day. And I'm having a situation where I'm trying to manage all three, and this is the first time I've ever sponsored anybody, and the only thing I prayed for was one, and now I've got three. If you got any valuable suggestions, I'm willing to listen.
Yeah, I got a couple of them. One is you can do it as a class. Have them show up at your house at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning. Probably the most important thing I'll say is whatever your sponsor says I agree with. If you don't have one, get you a good one quick. But get through the book with them with a dictionary is what I recommend. And the other thing is I don't sponsor somebody who's not doing what I ask them to do. And I don't believe it's because I'm arrogant. It's because I can't help them. I only know one thing. I know that if they'll do these 12 steps and get active in this fellowship, their lives will be phenomenal. And if they don't, they won't. I have to be hard-nosed about it because I don't want to be somebody's sponsor record the next time he wrecks a car or goes to jail or kills somebody. I do insist, and top of page 96 in the text talks about not working with somebody who won't work with you. I remember the first time my sponsor told me to fire a guy I was sponsoring. I thought he was kidding me, and he meant it. And he asked me a great question. He said, could you stay sober on the program this guy's working? And I said, no. And he said, well, he probably can't either. He said, you've got to fire him because you're not his sponsor anyway. You're his fire chief. And every time his tail feathers are on fire, he calls you. He siphons off some of your serenity. We put out his smoldering tail feathers, and he goes off doing it his way again. You're not helping this guy, and he's not helping you. And I want you to go fire him, and I had to do that because I need to stay surrendered to my sponsor. And it was one of the best things I ever did for me because that guy did go back to prison. He went back pretty fast after that. And it wasn't because I fired him. It was because he wasn't doing what I was asking. Because I was asking him to do little things like call his parole officer, look for a job, start reading the book, go to some meetings. I mean, it's not like I was trying to run his life. Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember one more thing. I met you about a little bit more than 2 years ago. And there was one thing that you spoke about when you were in Daytona. And it was at the end of the speech. You said, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know he had help. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, Mark.
That's good.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
Member of the Central Orlando Group.
This is probably a question that's got several questions contained in it. I don't know how many, but I'll just do the best I can with it. About the obsessive perfectionism thing that some of us can get into with this fourth step. I've written maybe 8 of them over the last 15 years, and I did this one that was straight out of the big book with this men's big book study group up in New England, and it got to the you mentioned something about 400 names on this thing, okay? Mine, I still got it at home, had 769 names on it. But they weren't just names. They were principles and institutions.
Yeah.
So, anyway, and this is a 28-year-old guy writing this, okay? So it's pretty evident that I did not like myself or anybody in this world because everybody I had ever met was on that list. Now, is that getting a little obsessed, a little obsessive? Let me ask, tell you why. Because in doing this, I saw, and I'll also mention that that I got drunk later on, but it wasn't just because of that. Mm-hmm. In doing this, and looking at this insurmountable task that I've created before me, or seeing it as an unsurmountable task, with having doing the causes, the effects, and then the turnarounds later on, and then writing, well, was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? I saw myself as writing this thing until I became an old-timer, you know, and for the first time through the fourth step, I think I built a Frankenstein. So anyway, that was what I wanted to put out to you, along with the just touching on principles and institutions, because I think a lot of fellas, they just write out names and stuff, and we didn't hear much about that.
Yeah, thank you. I got a couple observations. One of them is on principles and institutions, things like communism, the Presbyterian Church, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. What? Marriage? Yeah, it's an institution. There are a number of things like that that probably need to be down there. My own experience is I don't see any problem with 700 names on the list, and let's do the deal, because it's a question of let's do the work. And I think what you'll find with a list that long is I sponsored a guy who had the California Highway Patrol on his list. Not patrolmen, but patrol, all of them. I don't know how many that is, but it's quite a few. And as we began to get further into this inventory, he wanted to scratch him off the list. I said, why is that? And he says, well, I don't think they did anything wrong. I said, well, tell me about it. Boy, you got him on the list here. What happened? He says, well, he says, I think maybe if I hadn't been driving drunk and weaving all over the road that they wouldn't have pulled me over in the first place. So I can't resent them for that. They were just doing their job. And it's at least possible that if I hadn't taken a swing at one of them, they wouldn't have beat me up. And I said, okay, you can scratch them off. Because what happens is that so many times these resentments are imagined. It's things that happen in my head. And I like to go through the list and have them praying for these people until they're sure that they're clean on them, that these resentments are gone. Scratch them off the list. Because I think probably a large number of years might have scratched as you got further into the process. But I don't think it matters how long it takes. When you get to that part and start realizing these people are spiritually sick, I watched one guy, and he and I could have quit right there on the resentment inventory, because we were sitting in a restaurant and I showed it. We were covering this like we covered it tonight, and got to that part about we realized that the people who harmed us were perhaps spiritually sick. And when I said that, I saw him change. It was visible, it was physical, and it was huge. Boom, he was a different guy. You could see it. Something left him. And he still talks about it. And he said all of his resentments left at that point when he realized that they were spiritually sick. I've seen that. And I think it happens maybe a lot. A lot of times that one direction will clean off most of them. And it leaves with just a handful. It's not that difficult to get rid of them. Hi. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind going to the microphone. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sherry. I'm an alcoholic.
Sherry.
Hi. This is my 44th day of sobriety.
All right.
And my home group is the Trinity Group in St. Augustine. And I'm so grateful to everything I heard, because this has been looming over me. How do I do this? How do I do this? How do I do this? And I got a sponsor, and I'm afraid of my sponsor. And so I've really, a lot of my fears have been quelled quite a bit. I guess the fear part about the sponsorship is I was under the impression that, like, the fourth step and the fifth step are kind of, like, joined at the hip. But after the explanation on the fourth step, it seems to me that, boy, you should have talked about it probably to your sponsor a little bit, maybe, maybe not. And you certainly prayed about it and meditated on it. So I know this is jumping ahead, but what's that fifth step thing then? Because it seems like this, the way to do this fourth step, the way that you've explained it so logically, it seems like you're doing a fifth step kind of. Also, is it, am I...
Yeah, I think you're maybe a little bit ahead of yourself.
Okay.
To me, whatever your sponsor says, I say again, suits me just fine. But it's a process. I see the 10th and 11th steps run together. I see a lot of people, to me, they're different, but I see a lot of people mixing them together. I think that's great. What we have is a process. We have a way to get you cleaned out of your garbage. For me, the fifth step is a confession, very simply, where I did my fourth step pretty much by myself. But when I sit down with a sponsor, it is, in effect, a confession. I can share the directions there on page 75. As a matter of fact, our directions on how to take a fifth step is one sentence. Isn't that astonishing? And we have no directions on how to hear one, none whatsoever. It says we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Illuminating means to shine the light in. And that's what a fifth step is. And we have no directions on how to hear a fifth step. And so all I have is what my lineage gave me. And in my lineage, we don't listen to fifth steps. We exchange. And I would not hear your fifth step. I would be unwilling to do that. But if I were here to his, he would hear not all of mine, but the worst five or six things. Whether he had done them or not, I'd get them in, because I've got to keep them clean. My experience with my first fifth step was that I did not get the fifth step promises, which are the middle paragraph on page 75. Very powerful if you haven't read them. Didn't happen for me, because I knew when I walked out of that first fifth step that that stuff would never see the light of day again. And consequently, it was not available for God's use. And about a year later, I was sitting in the old Woodbine Clubhouse in Nashville. And after the meeting, there's a woman sitting at the end of the table just bawling her eyes out. And two or three trying to comfort her, and she was sobbing. And I walked up and said, "What's wrong?" And she told me, and she had done the very worst thing I'd ever done. And I knew what I had to do. And I sat down and told her my story. And you're going to hear that tomorrow. I'm not going to do it now. You'll hear it tomorrow morning. And I told her I got free. And I walked out of that clubhouse crying. And I hadn't learned to cry yet. I have learned since then. And I walked out of there about 3 feet off the ground. And my own perspective today is that I am two things. I'm God's caddy. I carry all of these things from my fifth step. All of these worst parts of my past are available to my God for use any way He wants to use them. I still carry them, but the pain and the weight is gone. I've received His forgiveness. And the thing that keeps them clean is my willingness for Him to use them. And we're going to do that tomorrow. I don't want to, but it's something that I know I have to do, because I've seen so many people helped, and that's why I do it. So I have to be available. I'm God's caddy. And the 12th step says I'm trying to carry the message. That makes me an apprenticed messenger. I figure if I was a messenger, I'd be carrying it. And when I hold that attitude, I'm an apprenticed messenger. And I'm a caddy. I do pretty good. That's my job. But you've got a big bite here in front of you, this 4th step. We have thrown a ton at you here. Get with your sponsor and work in little bitty pieces. Sometimes the willingness to do the next step comes from the previous step. Don't look ahead at some of this stuff. If I could tell you about my 1998, I had the privilege of coaching 4 newcomers through the step work. Started with 5. 1 was unwilling. 4. They're all sponsoring people today. I watched the lights come on in so many eyes. And I watched them go through the terrifying 9th step of making amends. I watched a family reunited. I watched miracle upon miracle upon miracle. I heard reports on the phone of guys crying about the fantastic things that happened in the terrifying 9th step. I saw no one hurt by it. It was astonishing. I was wrong about so many things. Thanks. Do you have something else? Thank you. Does anyone else? Sid, are you going to talk to us?
Me?
Are you walking out?
No, my name is Sid, and I'm a member of the Annie Lentz Group in Ormond Beach, Florida.
Hi, Sid.
part of my service work is to work with DOC people in a treatment center here in Daytona Beach, the Reality House. And one Sunday afternoon, I was sitting with a client, and we're going over the third step. And I say this because I'm sure other people assume, as I do, that we understand who or what God is. And we're talking about the God thing. And this person said to me, what kind of thing or person is your God? I said, well, I was brought up in Scotland where we were told, you better be good for goodness sake so you'll be outrunning the flames of hell licking at your behind. And I said, 1952, I came over here, and I said, the American God, I found out, was a loving and forgiving father. And I've thought that and known that for those 52 years. And all of a sudden, this person said, well, you see, that's my difficulty. It may be okay for you to believe in Father in heaven is a loving and forgiving father. He said, in my case, my father abused me until I left home at 16. What can I do about that? And I'll listen to you this afternoon in the third step. My answer truly was glib, and I feel ashamed to repeat what I told them. And I said, well, if you die and go to heaven, it won't make any difference anyway. End of story.
Thanks.
But the point is, we just assume that the other person sees a God or whatever it may be as we see them. And I was wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's really important, particularly if someone's been abused in a religion or in some way. I want to make my offer one more time, and I'm going to close. I'll take this. Go ahead.
I'm George, an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
I've had three sponsors, and none of them have pushed me to do the steps, or particularly the fourth step. I thoroughly understand 1 through 3. I've studied them a lot. Maybe I'm just looking for one more tip. I don't know. Trying to find a sponsor who I feel comfortable with and who will, you know, take me through the fourth step. I had 5.5 years sober, and then some things happened in my life. I slipped, and I've been slipping since. But I now have 2.5 weeks.
And wow. Welcome back. I'm so glad you made it.
Thank you. I don't intend to slip again because I'm going to do the work and work the steps.
Yeah. I think it's fair to interview a potential sponsor to ask the question, have you done the steps? Will you coach me through the steps? Mm. How did you do a fourth step? What do you do on a fifth step? What do you believe about 9? Tell me about your God. Those are fair questions. Mm. You know, all of my life they assigned me teachers. All of my life. Mm. They don't do that here. Mm. I get to choose my mentors here. Choose well. And I don't need a sponsor I can relate to. I never needed that. I need a sponsor I will obey. And I will only obey one that's having a great time, that is carrying the message. And I think if you'll take a look at what I talked about, a guy who's done the steps, who has a sponsor, who will tell you the truth, who's active in service, and who laughs a lot, you'll probably find the guy you're looking for. You may not like him. You know, don't need to like him. I just need one I'll obey. And I got one. And I'm so blessed. But the light's on. The lights are on. And the people who've done this step work has been my experience. I'd like to say something else, and I'll probably say it tomorrow. Thank you. And that's that in my tenure, I have not yet seen anyone in and out of the program. I ain't seen it yet. I've heard it, but on close inspection, I haven't seen it. In and out of the fellowship, you betcha, I've seen trainloads. I have not seen anyone do these 12 steps, take the 12 steps, whatever you want to call it, the action verb, and stay active in this fellowship and drink. Have you seen it, Sid? Murphy? I haven't seen it. Don't expect to. This program doesn't fail. We fail to do it. We have a tradition that says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. That is not the only requirement for sobriety. That's why I'm so glad to see you all here. Because there's a guy in Nashville that says, if I could give every newcomer coming through the door one thing, just one thing, it'd be 500 cc's of desperation right in the butt. Just load them right up. Those who are desperate enough to actually do this work are going to live a phenomenal life. That has been my experience, and I have not seen exceptions to that. Hi.
Hi, this is Jeff again. I'm double dipping.
You were mentioning something before about willingness, and as I mentioned before, I'm sponsoring three people. Two of them I'm not spending very much time with, but they're picking it up right away. This one guy I'm spending hours upon hours upon hours. He comes into the club the next day, whoops, I slipped again. And this has been going on for a period of about a week or so. And he'll listen to this tape because I'll get it. Would you please give some advice to him?
No, I'd give some to you.
Okay.
My sponsor does not allow me to work at Losers. As soon as we can establish that someone's not doing what I ask him to do, I'm instructed to drop them. He says he'd rather have me on the golf course. It's better for my program. It's pretty harsh. Ms. Linda and I did a couple hours on sponsorship in Mississippi. I don't know whether Lee's got it or not, but we talk about that rather in depth. And we're going to run out of time. I'll be glad to talk to you in depth about that tonight, and I'd love to. But I can't drag somebody. It's not good for them. It's not good for me. As a sponsor, it's my responsibility to give assignments. I had the privilege last year of picking up a man who had 27 years of sobriety. I am very impressed with how much sobriety he has. But I can't afford. He can't afford for me to be impressed by it. Man needs a sponsor, and he asked me, and I'm honored. And I only know one thing to do. I took him through the book. That's all I know how to do. And he hadn't seen the four step like this. And you ought to hear him talk about it. I got goosebumps all over me. The ones who do the deal are the ones I need to work with. I'm sponsoring a lot of guys. I got room for one more winner. That sign's always hanging out. I'll take one more winner because they're so easy to work with. But I ain't got time to drag anybody that's not doing the deal. I want to make good my offer one more time. If somebody feels like they've got committed the unforgivable sin, please see me and let me tell you about mine. And maybe we can get you some relief. And I really mean that. If you're holding something that you think is just the end of it, please see me and let's talk about it. I know a God that can handle it. And I'd like to say thank you all for the opportunity to pass on what has so freely been given to me. I have seen the light come on in so many eyes at step four, where we faced and were rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Isn't it astounding? The fourth step is not about writing. I thank you all so much. And let's just close with the Lord's Prayer. Thanks a lot, Mark.